The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the library. It's a great warm venue for a cold evening. My name is Nadia Daniel, and I am a Pepper of the Pepper Society here at the library. Many of you in the audience know what that is. For those of you who don't know, I am just one of many patrons here at the library who support the library financially in ways to allow it to do all the great, creative, wonderful things that like tonight's event. Now, for those of you who are paying attention to the video, that is not the first time we've shown it. It's an inspiring viewpoint of the things that the library does. And since I have the bully pulpit for just 2 minutes before Sue comes on, I'd like to take the opportunity to ask everyone who values the library, and if you're in the audience, I'm sure you do, to take a moment and think about the wonderful programs that the library offers, like tonight's program. And maybe, you know, when you pull out your purses to turn off your phones for tonight, you'll think about making a donation to the library. You can either join the Peppers, you can make a foundational gift, but do consider it. So on to little housekeeping. Do take those phones out. Disable the ringer. If you have a flash photography and you want to take some pictures, you're welcome to, but just disable the flash. And there will be a book signing tonight with Sue upstairs. And all of these programs are available on the webcast on the library and podcast format. So in a moment, Sue's going to come out here. And I just have to say, a few of us enjoyed some dinner with her upstairs. And you are going to be amazed at the wonder of Sue Monk Kidd. I don't know if those of you who read The Secret Life of Bees like I did over 10 years ago, you know, the 14-year-old world of Lily Owens, I think, was an inspiration to me. Her books have been turned into movies. This latest book of hers, The Invention of Wings, she mentioned to us tonight, actually takes place in parts in Philadelphia, the Arch Street Meeting House on 4th Street, and it follows the lives of these two women. So it is my pleasure to cease talking and introduce Sue Monk Kidd.
Hello, Philadelphia. I'm so happy to be here in your city again and to be back at this wonderful library. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for inviting me again. The opening four paragraphs of my new novel are this. There was a time in Africa the people could fly. My mama told me this when I was 10 years old. She said, "Handful, your granny mama saw it for herself. She say they flew over trees and clouds. She say they flew like blackbirds. When we came here, we left that magic behind." My mama was shrewd. She didn't get any reading and writing like me. Everything she knew came from living on the scarce side of mercy. She looked at my face, how it flowed with sorrow and doubt. And she said, "You don't believe me? Where you think these shoulder blades of yours come from, girl?" Those skinny bones stuck out from my back like nubs. She patted them and said, "This all what left of your wings. But one day, you gonna get them back." I was shrewd like mama. I knew this story about people flying was pure malarkey. We weren't some special people who lost our magic. We were slave people, and we weren't going anywhere. It was only later I saw what she meant. We could fly all right, but there wasn't any magic to it. These opening lines are in the voice of my character, Hetty Handful Grimke, an enslaved woman in the early 19th century, Charleston, South Carolina. And I wanted to quote them to you because, in a way, they contain the distilled essence of the whole novel. My husband wanted me to point out that that does not mean you don't need to read the story. But it does seem to have the seed of the story there, of our human quest for freedom, our ability to invent our wings, that thing in the human spirit that transcends, that seeks flight. In 2007, I went to the Brooklyn Museum for the express purpose of seeing the Judy Chicago dinner party exhibit. I had never seen it. And at the time, I was writing a memoir with my daughter, Ann Kidd Taylor. It was a mother-daughter travel memoir we were writing. And I wasn't looking for any kind of novel idea. It's like when that antenna tried to go up, I'd tap it right back down. I had to stay on task with this book. All I had was this very vague notion that I wanted to write a novel maybe next time about two sisters. That's all I had really was I didn't know who they were, where they lived, or anything about them. It was just this little scrap of an idea. And while I was at the dinner party, I was looking at the heritage panels, which list the names of 999 women who have made significant contributions to American and Western history. I was reading the names of all 999 of those women. I was determined to do it. And then I came upon the names of two sisters, Sarah and Angelina Grimke. And lo and behold, they were from Charleston, South Carolina, where I was living. I had never heard of them. This seemed incredibly wrong to me that I had not heard of them. A real failure on my part somehow. And maybe it speaks to Judy Chicago's whole premise of the dinner party exhibit that sometimes women's contributions in history sort of fall by the wayside. I was astonished to discover that for about a decade, I had been driving by their house, their unmarked house in Charleston, unaware of who they were. They were the first female abolition agents in America, officially by the American Anti-Slavery Society, and they were from the South. They were among the earliest American feminist thinkers. Sarah wrote a comprehensive feminist manifesto, the first one probably in our country. Sarah was the first woman to speak before a legislative body in Massachusetts. I read everything I could find about these women. And I was so awed by their lives, by what they accomplished. They were from a very wealthy, slave-holding family at the top of the planter class in Charleston, and that is saying a lot in Charleston. But there are few women who have ever misbehaved so wonderfully as these two women. You could argue, perhaps, that they were the most radical women to come out of the antebellum South, and certainly Charleston. I just fell in love with them. They underwent a very long, painful metamorphosis. They had to break away from their home, their traditions, their family, everything that they knew, and they became exiles in Philadelphia, who welcomed them. And they became pariahs in Charleston, and this is in the 1830s. Almost from the first moment that I knew, and it was pretty quickly that I knew, here are my sisters, and I'm going to write a novel. But I was moved mostly by Sarah, and I wanted her to narrate the book, but I also knew that I needed to and really wanted to have a second character that would narrate the other half of this story, and it needed to be an enslaved woman. And in fact, I rather felt like if I could not write the story of an enslaved woman in her voice and entwine it with the life of Sarah Grimke, that I could not write this novel. I was reading in Sarah's diaries, and I discovered that she had what is euphemistically called a waiting maid that was given to her when she was a girl, probably around 11 or 12 years old. This waiting maid was, of course, an enslaved girl in the Grimke household, and she was little more than a girl herself, probably younger than Sarah. All we really know about this girl is that her name was Hetty. She was given to Sarah. Sarah taught her to read, which was against the law in South Carolina. They were punished for this crime. And then later, at some point, Hetty died very young, probably in early adolescence. When I read this, everything in me lit up because I knew this is the other half of the story. I wanted to tell the story of Hetty. In other words, to give her a story and a life in this novel and imagine what might have been. And I named her Hetty Handful, and you will soon find out why. And I fell in love with her every bit as much as I fell in love with Sarah and her sister Angelina. Now, that isn't to say I wasn't intimidated by the idea of writing in the voice of an enslaved woman or girl. This was going to take me further out on the writing limb than I had ever ventured, and I knew that. And taking on something as large and formidable as American slavery. I would go to bed at night and wake up in the middle of the night and wonder what I was doing. The surprising thing for me, though, as I began writing, was that Hetty Handful's voice came to me with more ease. It was more accessible to me than Sarah's. I can't really fully explain that to you or to myself. I think it may have something to do with the notion that Sarah came with the historical script, perhaps, and I was more or less confined by that script. Hetty had free rein of my imagination, but she had a lot to say to me, and she talked an awful lot, and I could hardly at times keep up with all that she wanted to say to me. It was really surprising to me. I had to free Sarah and find her in my imagination the same way I had discovered her in history, and it was only when I was able to do that that her voice began to flow for me. Never quite in the same way, but she came alive for me as a character at that point. So it's very interesting and challenging to write from that place where history and imagination intersect. So the novel is really a blend of fact and fiction. I think if you read the novel, you will come away with a very good, sound sense of who Sarah Grimke is and what she accomplished. I've also grafted on a lot of conjured scenes and ideas and imagination. The novel spans 35 years, has a lot of characters in it, many of them historical figures. And what I can really only do tonight is just give you a glimpse of each of the characters, introduce you to Sarah and to Handful and to their voices, who each narrate this novel in alternating chapters. I like to begin my novels, the other two, along with this one, in what Joseph Campbell, the mythologer, called the ordinary world. And he said that all the great classic myths and stories start in the protagonist or ordinary world, and then there's a call to adventure, which pulls them out of their ordinary world into the whole narrative arc of the story. So I'm going to read a couple of brief passages from Handful in her ordinary world at the beginning of the novel, just before this call to adventure comes. The year is 1803, when Handful is 10 years old, and the place is Charleston, South Carolina. Already that morning, Mrs. had taken her cane stick to me once across my backside for falling asleep during her devotions. Every day, all us slaves, everyone but Rosetta, who was old and demented, jammed in the dining room before breakfast to fight off sleep, while Mrs. taught us short Bible verses like Jesus wept and prayed out loud about God's favorite subject, obedience. If you nodded off, you got whacked right in the middle of God said this and God said that. I was full of sass to Aunt Sister about the whole miserable business. I'd say, let this cup pass from me, spouting one of Mrs. verses. I'd say, Jesus wept because he's trapped in there with Mrs. like us. Aunt Sister was the cook. She'd been with Mrs. since Mrs. was a girl. And next to Tomfrey, the butler, she ran the whole show. She was the only one who could tell Mrs. what to do without getting smacked by the cane. Mama said, watch your tongue. But I never did. Aunt Sister popped me backward 3 times a day. I was a handful. That's not how I got my name, though. Handful was my basket name. The master and Mrs., they did all the proper naming, but a mama would look on her baby laid in its basket, and a name would come to her. Something about what her baby looked like, what day of the week it was, what the weather was doing, or just how the world seemed on that day. My mama's basket name was Summer, but her proper name was Charlotte. She had a brother whose basket name was Hard Time. People think I make that up, but it's true as can be. If you got a basket name, you at least had something from your mama. Master Grimke named me Hetty, but mama looked on me the day I came into the world, how I was born too soon, and she called me Handful. This next passage that I want to read from Handful comes the day of the infamous birthday party. And this, in my mind at least, is the call to adventure in the story. It sets the story in motion. On Sarah's 11th birthday, Handful is brought into the gathering, festooned in lavender ribbons. And this is the catalyst that will bring these two characters together for the rest of their lives and forever change them, and they are going to shape each other's destinies after this. This passage comes soon after this birthday party as Handful is trying to get the hang of being a waiting maid for the first time. Mrs. said, I was the worst waiting maid in Charleston. She said, you are abysmal, Hetty, abysmal. I asked Miss Sarah what abysmal means, and she said, not quite up to standard. I could tell from Mrs.'s face, there's bad, there's worse, and after that comes abysmal. That first week, beside the smoke, I spilled lamp oil on the floor, leaving a slick spot, broke one of those porcelain vases, and fried a piece of Miss Sarah's red hair with a curling tong. Miss Sarah never tattled. She tugged the rug over to cover the oily place, hid the broke porcelain in a storeroom in the cellar, and cut off her singed hair with the snuffer we used to snip the candle wick. Only time Miss Sarah rang her bell for me was if Mrs. was headed our way. Miss Sarah's warning bell gave me some extra lead on my rope, and I took it. I would rove down the hallway to the front alcove, where I could see the water in the harbor float to the ocean, and the ocean roll on till it sloshed against the sky. Nothing could hold a glory-bound picture to it. First time I saw it, My feet hopped in place, and I lifted my hand over my head and danced. That's when I got true religion. I didn't know to call it religion back then. Didn't know amen from what when. I just knew something came into me that made me feel the water belonged to me. I would say, that's my water out there. I saw it turn every color. It was green one day, then brown, next day yellow as cider, purple, black, blue. It stayed restless, never ceasing. Boats coming on top, fishes underneath. I would sing these little verses to it. Cross the water, cross the sea, let them fishes carry me. If that water take too long, carry me on, carry me on. After a month or two of doing more things right in the house, even Miss Sarah didn't know. Some nights, I left my post by her door and watched the water all night long, the way it broke silver from the moon, the stars shining big as platters. I missed our bed. I missed the quilt frame guarding over us. I pined for Mama when it was dark. I pictured her sewing quilts by herself. I would think about the gunny sack stuffed with feathers, the red pouch with our pins and needles, my pure brass thimble. Nights like that, I hightailed it back to the stable room. Every time Mama woke and found me in bed with her, she had a fit, saying all the trouble there would be if I got caught, how I already lived too far out on Mrs. Badside. Ain't nothing good gonna come from you wandering off like this, she said. You got to stay put on your quilt. You do that for me, you hear? And I'd do it for her, at least for a few days. I'd lay on the floor in the hall, trying to stay warm in the draft, twisting round in search of the softest floorboard. I could make do with that misery and take my solace from the water. When someone says slavery, we might reflexively think about plantation slavery. It seems to come most readily to mind somehow, cotton fields and slave cabins perhaps. Urban slavery that was taking place in Charleston during this time was something quite different, actually. Charleston was a place known as the crown jewel of the South, a lot of wealth, a lot of opulence, and the city teemed with enslaved people. On any given day, the city was really alive with many, many slaves on the streets, on errands, going to and from work. And this whole system existed on surveillance and control. It operated very differently than plantation slavery, but it was every bit as brutal. So there were curfews, there were city guard, badges, passes, ordinances, searches, and something called the workhouse, which I did not know about until I researched this novel, and which was undoubtedly the most disturbing thing, perhaps, that I found. It was euphemistically called in the literature as the sugar house, and owners could send slaves there to be punished, or, as they said, to be put in the right frame of mind. You could purchase 20 lashes for half a dollar. So you see how terribly disturbing this is, and it's not that well known, these workhouses. But this was part of urban slavery, and it was in this environment in Charleston that one of the largest and least known slave plots in America was hatched, the Denmark Vesey plot. And I decided to include this plot in the novel and to entwine Handful's life and her mother Charlotte's life with this plot in a significant way, mainly because I wanted to acknowledge, at least in some way, the way that enslaved people resisted, the way they plotted and struggled and died and really rebelled and subverted the system. It's something that I came across in the literature over and over. And if you read the narratives, as I did, reading through the 19th century slave narratives, you get a whole other picture of how this happened than sometimes if you read history. I was daunted, really, as I said, about writing something as large as slavery. I don't know why novelists gravitate to the subjects they do. It does seem sometimes we gravitate over and over to similar things. And I have been drawn to write about race and race relations. I think there is probably some mystery in it, but I also think it's personal to me. It feels like part of my history, like the stuff of my history. I grew up in the South, in Georgia, in the 50s. I was a child in the 50s and came of age in the 60s there. And I witnessed many things, great racial divides. The backdrop of my childhood and adolescence, or particularly my adolescence, was Rosa Parks and the civil rights movement. And I was 13 when Martin Luther King Jr. was jailed in the town where I was born, 20 miles from where I was living at the time. So it feels like it's woven into my life. I think of the novelist James Baldwin, who said, race is a common history. It's both white race and black race, and it is a common history. And I guess I feel this way. So writing about slavery was a way for me to go back to the very roots of racism, to ground zero, slavery, which left us a legacy of racism. And I think of it as an American Holocaust, frankly. It has left us with this legacy in a highly racialized society, and I don't think we've fully healed that wound, and I don't think we've eradicated what is surely America's original sin. And that legacy still lingers, but it does seem to me we're coming to terms with a great deal of that. Well, I want to introduce you now to Sarah. This passage that I want to read from Sarah comes the night after the birthday party. And Sarah is at her wit's end of what to do, because even as an 11-year-old, she's already got, for very good reasons that are in the book, an abolitionist heart already beating in her chest. Sliding from my perch, I stole to the window where I shivered in my white woolen gown, gazing along East Bay past the dark rooftops toward the harbor. Plastering my cheek against the frigid pane, I discovered I had a partial view of the slave quarters above the carriage house, where I knew Hetty to be spending her last night with her mother. Tomorrow she would take up her duties and sleep outside my door. It was then I had a sudden epiphany. I lit a candle from the dwindling coals in the fireplace, opened my door, and stepped into the dark, unheated passageway. Three dark shapes lay on the floor beside the bedroom doors. I'd never really seen the world beyond the nursery at night, and it took me a moment to realize the shapes were slaves sleeping close by in case a Grimke rang his bell. I crept barefooted down the wide mahogany stairs to the first floor, where two more slaves slept, along with Cindy, who sat wide awake with her back against the wall outside my parents' chamber. I picked my way along the rug that ran the near length of the main passage, turned the knob to Father's library, and stepped inside. An ornately framed portrait of George Washington was lit with a scrim of moonlight coming through the front window. For almost a year, Father had looked the other way as I'd slipped beneath Mr. Washington's nose to plunder the library. John, Thomas, and Frederick had total reign over his vast trove, books of law, geography, philosophy, theology, history, botany, poetry, and the Greek humanities, while Mary and I were officially forbidden to read a word of it. Mary didn't seem to care for books, but I dreamed of them in my sleep. Mary and I dreamed of them in our sleep sometimes together. I love them in a way I couldn't fully express, even to Thomas. He pointed me to certain volumes and drilled me on Latin declensions. He was the only one who knew my desperation to acquire a true education, beyond the one I received at the hands of Madame Ruffin, my tutor and French nemesis. She was a small, hot-tempered woman who wore a widow's cap with strings floating at her cheeks, and when it was cold, a squirrely fur coat and tiny fur-lined shoes. She was known to line girls up on the idle bench and scream at them until they fainted. I despised her and her polite education for the female mind, which was composed of needlework, manners, drawing, basic reading, penmanship, piano, Bible, French, and enough arithmetic to add 2 and 2. I thought it possible I might die from tracing teensy flowers on the pages of my art tablet. Once I wrote in the margin, "If I should die of this horrid exercise, I wish these flowers to adorn my coffin." Madame Ruffin was not amused. I was made to stand on the idle bench where she ranted at my insolence and where I forced myself not to faint. Increasingly, during those classes, longings had seized me, foreign torrential aches that overran my heart. I wanted to know things, to become someone. Oh, to be a son. I adored Father because he treated me almost as if I were a son, allowing me to slip in and out of his library. And that night, the coals in the library's fireplace lay cold, and the smell of cigar smoke pooled in the air. Without effort, I located Father's South Carolina Justice of the Peace and Public Laws, which he himself had authored. I thumbed through it enough to know somewhere in the pages was a copy of a legal manumission document. Upon finding it, I took paper and quill from Father's desk and copied it. "I hereby certify that on this day, 26 November 1803, in the city of Charleston in the state of South Carolina, I set free from slavery Hetty Grimke and bestow the certificate of manumission upon her, Sarah Moore Grimke." What could Father do but make Hetty's freedom as legal and binding as her ownership? I was following a code of law he'd fashioned himself. I left my handiwork atop the backgammon box on his desk. And of course, this will not work, will it? I think this scene begins to hint at the other major motif in the novel, which is gender, which is women and women's rights. As a white woman in South Carolina in the early 1800s, even a privileged one like Sarah, her life was vastly limited. In many ways, women were the property of their husbands. You could argue that, I think. Their deemed purpose in life. This was shocking to me as I read this in the research, just how limited it really was. Their purpose in life was to marry, have children, and live out their life in the domestic sphere, with the exception, of course, Madame Ruffin's in the world. It's important to say, I think, that their lack of freedom, however, in no way compared to the subjugation of enslaved people, particularly women. And I tried really hard to never lose sight of that. But there was a kind of twinned slavery going on here. Just like I came of age in pre-civil rights South, I came of age in pre-feminist America. I remember what that was like, too. In 1963, I was in my freshman home economics class in high school, learning how to make a man's home into a castle. Do you remember that? And I remember the day they wrote the occupations for women on the blackboard because it was very short. And I had this deep desire to be a writer. and it was not on the board. And I remember it very clearly. So when I went to college, what do you suppose I studied? Nursing. And, you know, I chose it because I think it's an incredibly noble profession. I wish I had been a good nurse. I wanted to be, and I tried very hard, and I did nurse until I was 30 years old. But it wasn't my place of belonging. Inside, I was a writer, and I was always yearning to be a writer. It took me 8 years after graduating from college to break out, to find my own voice, find my own daring, my own consciousness, my own truth, and begin to find a way to articulate that in the world. And that sort of kind of reminds me of Sarah. I think Sarah and I both shared some failures of courage and were often slow to come to it, to take the leap, you know. There is a moment in the novel where Handful looks at Sarah and she says, "My body might be a slave, but not my mind. For you, it's the other way around." So they're both questing for freedom. They're both trying to invent their wings, but very different kinds of freedom. Sarah's quest was to find her selfhood and the boldness to express that. One of the things I wanted to get across in this novel is that in fighting for the rights of others, it was how women in this country discovered the oppression of their own lives. This is historically true, even in the 60s. The Grimke sisters were the ones who linked abolition and slavery, abolition and women's rights. And they were what I would call female incendiaries. In fact, I did call them that in the novel, because they lit a spark that would go on and flare into something much larger. They were out there 10 years before Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott at the Seneca Falls Convention in New York. They were out there fighting a battle for a woman's right to speak in the public sphere, and they were getting incredible backlash and even violence from that. There's a line in the novel that I loved writing. I'm going to tell you what it is, because if you read the book and you come to it, you'll know that's my favorite line in the novel. It's just four words, and I put them into the mouth of Lucretia Mott, who's a character in the book, who sends word to Sarah and Angelina at the height of backlash against them. They were in Massachusetts. And she sent a message, and it said, "Press on, my sisters." In closing, I'll just say, I've been asked many times, what do you hope readers will take away from this story, this novel? Well, it would please me, of course, if readers would learn something new, perhaps. I think every novelist probably wants their book to be a carrier of ideas in some way that would start some kind of conversation. To learn something about 19th century urban slavery in Charleston, or rediscover the Grimke sisters of South Carolina. To learn something about history. But I suppose what I most would want is for the reader to have a felt experience of this book, to really feel it. See, I'm always after the heart. That's what I'm always after. Because that's the seat of the will. That's where we change our lives. As wonderful as it is to ignite the mind, we need both the mind in the heart, I think. So I would hope for the reader to take the experience and make it their own in some way, empathetically, to feel what it was like to be an enslaved woman at that time, or a white woman without any rights and so many limitations. When I was in college, I studied the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson, which had a big impact on me. And I remember reading about his concept of the common heart, which is simply the idea he had that in every human being, we carry this innate unity with all humanity, that there is a place in us where we do that. It sounds a lot like empathy. But I love this concept of the common heart, and I suppose that would be my wish, that my novel would be a portal into that. And that's the real power of fiction, you see. It is this ability of fiction to create empathy in us and take us into this place called the common heart. Every day as I wrote, I had a little card propped on my desk, and I read these words over and over for 4 years while I wrote this book. And they are words by Professor Julius Lester, who said, "History is not facts and events only. History is a pain in the heart. And we will repeat history until we are able to take another's pain and make it our own." Thank you.
Nice job. So about 15 minutes of questions. Okay.
Hi, everyone. As you know, this is our Q&A period, so if you raise your hand, we will get a microphone to you right in the center there.
About 20 or 25 years ago, I visited Charleston and went on a historical walking tour led by a woman who was about my age at the time, who referred to the Civil War as the recent unpleasantness. I'm curious about what that woman would think of this book today and whether she is likely to have discovered a common heart.
I may hear from that woman. I don't know. We'll see. Well, I'm not sure what the woman would think today. Let's hope for some evolvement since then, 25 years ago. I certainly have seen it in Charleston. I lived in Charleston for 13 years. And I think for a long time, there was an unwillingness that mirrors a lot of the country's feeling, but very potent there. Not to really look clearly at the history and legacy of slavery. No one wants to look at that. And I think sometimes that whole era in history can be romanticized in a not good way. And you certainly can see that, traces of that still, I suppose. But I know that Charleston is also a great and progressive city, and I've seen enormous change there and a willingness to look at this, to do archaeological studies on the plantations there and to make this more accessible to everyone, the history of what really happened. I mean, I think we have a long way to go, though, with that, being willing as people, particularly there but everywhere, to look at this without flinching, you know. That's the only way to really heal this situation, I think.
Another question. All the way in back on the left, and then, yeah, then we'll go to the person in turquoise there.
First, thank you for having the courage to become a writer for our sake. Two questions about research. The quilts, the black triangles, that were supposed to be the birds. I was wondering if you had actually done research on that, on the quilting itself, and if you had ever researched into your own background to find out if, in fact, your own family had owned slaves. Thank you.
The quilt in the story is based on the slave quilts of Harriet Powers, who created, I think, masterpieces of art and narration in a quilt. She told stories. And this gave me the inspiration to give my character, Charlotte, She was a seamstress, and she created quilts that could tell her story. It was really a defiant and subversive act to record her experience, the real truth of it, unsugar-coated truth of her life and what was done to her, how her life was stolen and what she had endured. She told it in a quilt and left it in plain sight often. The black triangles are from in certain parts. Yes, I did a lot of research about African imagery and symbol, particularly in textiles, and how that that tradition came to this country and persevered in a lot of the early slave quilts. So few of them survive. The Harriet Powers quilts are archived now in the Smithsonian American History Museum and in Boston, the Museum of Fine Arts. But the black triangle does represent, in some parts of Africa, the blackbird or wings, which is why Charlotte always put black triangles on her quilts. And the other question had to do with researching my family to see if there was slavery. We have done some genealogical work, not like most people extensively, but some. And we can't find any record of slaves owned in our family. In fact, the Monk side of my family, we just had the anniversary of 185th anniversary of our family farm. And we all gathered there for what we call Founders Day. And we know that the people who, the monks, William and Elsie, who founded that, they were squatters. They didn't have a dime to their name. So it might be that, the monk side of my family didn't have enough money to own slaves. But we haven't found any evidence of it. Doesn't mean it's not there, though.
Yes, on our right.
Hello. Hi, Sue. Thank you so much for your work. It has meant so much to me as a writer and as a woman. In fact, my mom and I are taking a trip to France inspired by traveling with pomegranates, which we're thrilled about. So thank you. And my question is, if in researching this novel you found anything about Philadelphia that surprised you or might surprise this local audience?
Oh, I hardly doubt I could surprise this audience on Philadelphia, but but it was really wonderful part of my research to read about history in Philadelphia at the time, because the Grimke sisters both came, Sarah first, and they lived most of their life, well, here, and then moved on to Boston and New Jersey. But I was able to go the other day to the Arch Street Meeting House and walk around, and I was so thrilled to be there. I can't tell you, because I could imagine this is where the sisters, this is where Sarah and Angelina were and were part of that meeting house, that group, that meeting. And I could just imagine them there, you know, and I could feel their presence in their history. You know, I had to do a lot of research on Quakers, and I'm sure that I hope I got it mostly right. But what was astonishing to me that I didn't know, because I had read some of George Fox and other things earlier in my life, it's just part of a kind of search of classic spiritual writings. But I didn't realize that there were, at that time in the 1830s, this conservative element of the Quakers and the more liberal element of Quakers, and how that created a split. And you had the Hicksites and all of this. And I mean, that was fascinating to me, and that Lucretia Mott had to leave Arch Street and go to a more liberal meeting, because there was a kind of silencing, even though I have great admiration for the Quakers, because they put forth the first anti-slavery document in American history, maybe in history, I don't know. That's quite something, you know, and had female ministers. This is what attracted Sarah to it, were these two things. And she found sanctuary there, and she was moved by that religion. And at the same time, they ended up kicking her out. She was thrown out eventually. So she had a hard time of it, but she was in the more conservative element of it. So I learned interesting things in my research, but I doubt I could surprise any of you.
Believe me, if you got it wrong, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
Another question, all the way in back on the right.
Back before Christmas, I went to a used bookstore in my neighborhood and was browsing around in the religion section and came across some Thomas Merton. And there was an edition at that time called the New Edition of Seeds of Contemplation. And who had written the foreword or introduction or whatever it was Sumang Kid. So I'm wondering, this great master of contemplation and you visiting his hermitage, what influence or what practice might contribute to your own professional life or your work?
Have a strong contemplative bent. Merton was important to me. I read his biography, his autobiography when I was 29 years old. And it rocked my world because I didn't know until then that we have an interior life. And that was an astonishing awakening for me. And this is what woke me intellectually. It woke me spiritually. It woke my heart. And I began a journey, I guess you would say, of really reading. I read through the classics. I read philosophy. I read psychology. I discovered the work of C.G. Jung, which I discovered the work of Jung was talking about essentially the same thing Merton was talking about in the interior life, the depth of the human soul and the psyche. And this was very compelling to me. But what was interesting was that this coincided with the awakening of my creative life, and I'm sure they're entwined. I mean, that's my prayer, really, is my creative life. That's how I see it, anyway.
A few more questions? Yes, all the way in back in the center there, and then there's a lady. Why don't we start with this lady on our left, immediately on our left, and then you want to head all the way back.
Hi. Thanks for being here tonight. I'm enjoying your talk, and as much as I enjoyed the book. My question to you is about the Grimke sisters and the lack of knowledge of them. I knew all about the Grimke sisters because I'm a student of history, read a lot of The Liberator, but when I read in your book that you had not known of the Grimke sisters, and other people that I've talked to about the book had no idea that they were real fiction, non-fictional characters, what do you think you can attribute to why we don't hear about, nobody hears about the Grimkes unless you're studying that period of history in depth?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can fully explain that. I don't know. I think part of it is, that you're even in South Carolina, they don't know them as well as we should. I think now they're in history books. They're certainly in academic circles. People seem to know about them in history, women's studies, that kind of thing. I meet people who will say, oh, right, the Grimke sisters. I think I took a course and I read something about them. Now, what did they do? It's this kind of feeling or knowing about them that's vague and amorphous. I don't know why they seem to have fallen in a little crack of history so that it's polarized, so you have them known like scholars and students like yourself of history, and then the rest of us, you know, who it seems we don't have them in the popular culture or American psyche the way we have Lucretia Mott or Elizabeth Cady Stanton or some of these other names that are in the book, for instance. I don't know why that is, but I'm hoping that people who read the book, you know, will go learn about them, the real sisters, because there's the real sisters and there's my characters, and they're not always exactly the same thing, you know.
There was a question all the way in back.
Hi, thank you very much for being here tonight and sharing the book. In reading the book, I was really struck by the way that I think religion and sort of some of the teachings of the church that Sarah was in really affected the way in which her mind was or was not free. And so I was wondering what your thoughts were in terms of sort of the relationship between religion and maybe the freeness of particularly women's intellectual mind.
Well, religion can be just about whatever we make it, you know. For instance, on one hand, we had the institution of religion justifying slavery at this time in the South. And at the same time, you had the Quakers in Philadelphia using religion to make an anti-slavery statement. I mean, both of them are religion, such as they are, whatever they are. I mean, I think that we define it, people define religion, and we use it in all kinds of ways, sometimes good and sometimes not so good, perhaps. But I do think for Sarah, there was a liberating influence for her in coming to the Quakers, but it was paradoxical. I mean, I'm ambivalent about it because at the same time, they also tried to hush her up. She was too radical for them, really. And she was shy. And she had a difficult time speaking. I find it fascinating that of all the religions, Sarah would gravitate to one that is about listening to the inner voice. Because she had a hard time speaking. And that's a big theme in this novel. It's about muteness and silence and voice. And daring to voice yourself. And how do we find that? Where does it come from? And so, you know, this was her quest, was to find her inner voice and be able to put it out there, which is what Quakers did. She was in worship often. She would struggle with that, you know. So it helped her to liberate her mind, but at the very same time, it was stifling for her, to be honest. So she struggled, you know.
Good questions tonight. Thank you very much, and thank you very much to Sue Monk-Kidd. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.